This is an interview for the Avon Heathcote Estuary Ehutai Trust. The date today is the 31st of March. The interviewer is Michelle Bradley. The interviewee is Peter Neal. The interview is being recorded in the Neal's Lounge at 192B Rocking Horse Road. The equipment being used is a Fostex FR2LE field recorder and two lapel microphones. This is interview one, session three. Today I would like to talk to Peter about his involvement with various community organisations and a bit about his experience, reflections of living here near the estuary and contrasting his whether his attitudes and values have changed over the decades that he's lived here. Peter, my understanding is that there's a local residence group here and that it's been established for a very long time. And have you been a part of that residence group for a good while?
Yes, I joined initially, I think, in the early 80s, and it was an off and on experience. I would do two or three years at a time, and at one point there for 2 years I was chairman of the group. I'm still involved with it. The Resident Association will call me in on different projects, the last one being the replanting, the re-establishment of the dune vegetation, especially after the last big fire. So I've been involved in that and still am.
So do they call you in for organisational reasons or for your opinion?
Yep. No, well, opinion, but organisation. If they're going to organise, say, a craft fair, because of my criticism on one particular one, which I thought was a bloody disaster, and from then on, they've got me in to be involved in the organisation of that sort of thing.
Do you recall why you first joined the group?
It was an interest in the area that prompted me, but there would have been issues that I had strong opinions about and wanted to put forward my opinions. But that's about it, really. I just wanted to be involved.
Can you remember some of those issues, or were there particular issues when you were chairman?
God, that's going to be a difficult question. There's always been issues of things like drainage. There's always been little issues. Buses, the lack of buses, the lack of bus stops. The drainage in the road, it's just general stuff like that.
And have you continued to be a member? Are you still a member?
No, I'm not actually a member, but as I say, I've probably been to more meetings than some of those on the committee.
You had told me that as a member of the South Shore Residents Association, you had also gone along as a representative of that group to the Combined Estuary Association meetings.
Yes.
Was that on issues that you went along?
Yes, it was, to a degree. I mean, I was the delegate from this association to the Estuary Association. At the time, yes, there were issues. There were certain people were trying to ban all motorised craft on the estuary, and I was against that because I think that the issues we had, such as the what do they call them, the lawnmowers on water,
water bikes,
we were having problems with jet boats and that sort of stuff, and the noise was, well, even for a deaf person like myself, was quite intolerable. Every weekend, all weekend. And the way they tried to combat that was to ban all motorised craft.
This is the Combined Estuary Association.
This is the Combined Estuary Association. There were one or two stalwarts on there who were trying to tackle it that way. And my rationale was that we had the power purely by enforcing the speed limit. All we had to do was enforce the speed limit, and that would have wiped all the problems that we had. And that was already there. It's always been a speed limit on the estuary, excepting for the Powerboat Association, which wasn't really an issue, as far as I was concerned, because they would only be there maybe once a month for 2 or 3 months of the year. So they weren't really an issue.
But what's the distinction between the jet boats and the power boats?
Well, the power boats were confined to one racing area in the estuary, right up by where the Avon meets. But they were not a huge issue because they would only be on that estuary maybe 3, 4, 5 times in a year. Whereas the jet skis would be there mostly through the week and all Saturday and all Sunday. So that was an issue.
And was it a simple matter of you voicing your opinion and the Combined Estuary Association took on board what you said, or was it quite a process that you had to
go through? It was a bit more involved in that, because the Combined Estuary Association got a petition going around Christchurch to bring forward this ban on motorboats. But I got my own petition going, and I did it through sports shops selling fishing tackle. So I had a captive audience there in a sense. And I finished that with double the signatures they got. I got records of all that in my file. But I finished that with roughly double the amount of signatures that they got to maintain the status quo and allow boats on the estuary, provided they stayed within a certain speed limit. And anybody out there fishing, of course, wouldn't be doing more than 4 knots anyway. So we won that one. We won that particular
thing.
And
the Powerboat Club were allowed to have their
that was
days.
That was a different issue, because the Powerboat Club lost it anyway, and they were moved on outside. But the ban was not so much on big boats, but the ban they tried to enforce was on every little small 8-foot dinghy with a 2-horsepower outboard, which was ridiculous.
Can you recall when that was? Do you think it was around the early 1980s?
It was round about then, yeah. I do have a record of it, but I can fill you in on that.
My investigation was that it was about 1981, 1982.
Could be.
And
yeah.
The petition, I'm guessing, was put to the City Council.
Yes.
Did you find that the City Council had a particular point of view?
They might have had, but it didn't show in their decision.
Do you think that there was a case for the people who were in boats to make as far as hazards and threats that they had to deal with because of the polluted environment?
Well, that's been an issue for years about the polluted environment. I was thinking then of an amusing thing where this particular individual was a very keen yachtsman, and he was complaining about the pollution of the estuary. And the bloke sitting alongside him made the point was, well, it wasn't polluted till you fell in it. But yes, it's always been an issue. And quite rightly so. But that issue then, it was more on the bug count rather than the real pollution, which is ammonium nitrate. That's the issue that I've been concerned about, is the ammonium nitrate in the water, not so much the bugs.
And you've been active in monitoring that through the water sampling program?
Yeah, yeah.
And how did you become involved with that?
Well, because the man who initiated all this was a good friend of mine, is a good friend of mine.
And who's that?
Les Batchelor. And he was the one who will, as long as he lives, will continue to look at the standards we're improving on in the estuary.
Do you feel as motivated as he is?
Can you say?
Do you match his motivation?
Yes, I don't match his tenacity.
And where have you been taking the water samples? My understanding is that you've discontinued doing that now, but where were you taking the samples from?
Down the end of the spit.
You mentioned that there were some stalwarts in the Combined Estuary Association who wanted to ban the powerboats. Have you come across other points of view that you have considered to be extreme, that the position that's been taken up in looking at environmental issues has been extreme, or that you have considered to be extreme?
No, I can't think of any now other than this powerboat thing.
Does it ever concern you that in caring for the environment that people do take up that point of view?
Oh yeah, you're going to get that. I know that. I always consider myself a moderate, but other people might not share that same view. But
do you think there's any damage to be caused by taking extreme points of view?
Well, there always is, because you're only looking at one point of view. Like this extreme idea of banning all small craft on the estuary. You're basically banning a lot of people from enjoying the fishing that we had then. And for what? For what? You've made no improvement, and you haven't made anything worse, you haven't made anything better. So why bother?
Now, you also went along to the Friends of the Estuary group for a while as well. Do you recall what interested you about attending their meetings?
Well, yes, I was always interested in the estuary and the management of the estuary, such as this ocean outfall. I could never understand how we as a so-called modern city could throw all our wastewater into what could be a pristine environment. So I always had that in the back of my mind, that we shouldn't be doing that. The Friends of the Estuary, they had a few views that I didn't agree with, but they weren't extreme views. That whole thing really was the brainchild of Roger Lushby, and he was the man that set it all up. And I went along with him at the inaugural meetings over there in Sumner. But there were views there that I just couldn't go along with.
Can you give me an example? Can you recall anything in particular?
Yeah. The view was that we should make the estuary more accessible to the general public and to create walkways all the way around it. And I couldn't see the point of that. Because on the one hand, we're saying we don't want to disturb the Godwits. And on the other hand, we're inviting Tom, Dick and Harry to come around the estuary. Some will have dogs, you can guarantee that, to walk around it. And by that doing that, we're upsetting the Godwits that are there. And my argument was that if people are genuinely interested in the estuary and what goes on there, they will be there anyway.
So were you actually of the view that there was possibly more adverse outcomes from having extended walkways than advantages, more disadvantages than advantages?
Well, I couldn't see the point in spending all that money in making pathways and boardwalks and whatever. I was interested in the estuary, and I had no trouble getting to any part of it. And my argument was that if you're going to encourage people who don't really have that affinity with the estuary, what's the point? If they're interested, they're interested. If they're not, they're not. End of story.
Can you recall if there was any other issue that you disagreed with?
There must have been quite a few. I can't recall them now. This powerboat business was the big one, as far as I was concerned. There's always been issues about people having little jetties into the estuary and little slipways for the boats, having areas where they could tie the boat up to on the estuary. And the idea was to ban all private access ways onto the estuary. And I really can't understand the rationale behind that, because if you go to somewhere like, say, Cornwall, the first thing an artist does is paints the boats that are there. He paints the little jetties and he paints all the different means of mooring the boats. And here we are in good old New Zealand trying to ban all that. And I really can't see the rationale behind it.
What about where private property restricts access to the waterway or to the water's edge?
Well, I was against that, but I was against it because I can't see what difference it made. But you've got to remember that I have my own little access way, so I was prejudiced.
I just, again, talking about matters to do with South Shore, in recent years you've contributed to the book Sand Dunes to Suburbs, which I've got over here. How did you come to take the job of writing that particular chapter, chapter 6?
I was asked. And I was asked to be on that committee for whatever reason, I don't know, but I was asked to contribute.
And how did you find approaching that particular task?
Good. Easy. Gives you a chance to talk to like-minded people.
So that's chapter 6, Aquatic Life. Have you had people respond to you personally about the publication at all?
No, I haven't. There might have been the odd comment here and there, but for me to recall them now, you don't get a lot of feedback. I mean, when I say that, for quite a couple of years or so, I was putting articles every month into the local rag, the Beacon, and I was posing questions, but I don't think I was ever got a response from anybody. Maybe they considered the whole thing to be a load of rubbish, and they might have been right.
Can you recall a question that you posed?
Well, the articles I did were about the wildlife and ecology on the estuary, mainly about the bird life on the estuary. And I can remember posing the question that as you walked around the estuary at night in the summer, your whole footprint would glow fluorescent green. And I was asking the question then, what are these things? I mean, I knew the answer, but I wanted to get a response from the local community, which I never did. There were other questions too, such as, if you read any book on bird life, they will tell you that the paradise duck, drake, does not sit on the eggs. And I posed a question, that, then why is it that during the nesting season, the only birds you see during daylight hours are the ducks, the female. You never see the male. So where is he? And my argument is that if nature would not put a duck sitting on eggs, that was the most visible. And in the case of the paradise duck, she's got a white head. She would stand out. Whereas the drake is extremely well camouflaged. So if I was looking after nature, I would say, but have the drake sitting on during the daytime because nobody can see him. But every book you read will say the opposite. And I don't necessarily agree with it.
So what do you think motivated you in posing those questions? Were you particularly wanting a response? Were you trying to raise curiosity, or was it a self-indulgence, or
a bit of everything there? But I was posing the question to make people think about it. I wasn't giving them an answer. I was just giving them a question to come up with their own answers.
Now, you had also mentioned that you were part of a group that made submissions for supporting the discontinuation of effluent discharge into the estuary. When you made that submission, were you representing a group?
Well, yes, I suppose I was asked by the Combined Estuary Association to put forward my submission regarding fish life in the estuary. More to the point on the shrimps in the estuary, which for some reason nobody seemed to know anything about. But especially in the early years, I was collecting them by the bucket load, and we were eating them. So I was asked to put forward my views on the decline of fish in the estuary, which I did. I gave an oral and a written submission.
Did you form impressions of the process? Did you find it a process that you came away with a positive view of it?
Not necessarily, because I had that view to start with.
And what view was that?
That the fish in the estuary had declined, and I've always put it down to the ammonium nitrate in the water. I mean, it's all very well improving the process of the ponds, which the council did beautifully, and the bug count was going down, and you could see it, you could smell the difference. But there was no economical means of removing the ammonium nitrate. And that was gradually increasing, and that's where I'm convinced the sea lettuce comes from, because it's a fertilizer. And the ammonium, part of that ammonium nitrate, will basically kill fish. It's a concentration enough to kill the fish, which is why we had a big decline in whitebait.
I've got a few final questions to ask you. Oh, this would be a good time just to mention that you recently went to the opening, the official opening of the of the ocean.
Yes.
Ocean outfill pipeline. It's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Well, I hope not. I wouldn't want you to get a mouthful of that.
Did you find that you had a mixed reaction to going along to that event?
Well, my observation there is that the City Council had issued invitations to a whole group of people. Now, I was one of a few who put forward the submissions and found the time and the energy to go to this business to get this pipeline installed, but I wasn't given an invitation, and that niggled me. I went anyway. They weren't going to keep me away from that. But what gets me is that the people standing there, glowing in this thing about this wonderful pipeline, were the very people that were against it in the first place. And that gets me. If they were against it, why have they changed their opinion all of a sudden? And they've changed their opinion because they can see the value of it. But they couldn't see the value of it at the start. And their argument was to continue putting it into the estuary because they didn't want to have the sewage going into the swimming area in the sea. And my argument has always been, well, where the bloody hell does it go to when it leaves the estuary? It goes into the sea, inside the breaker line. And for some reason, these so-called intelligent people couldn't see that. Now we've got it 3 kilometres out, and they're all saying, what a wonderful idea.
Have you noticed any phenomena, any change as a result of the beginning of the use of that or the activity of the development of the pipeline?
No, I haven't. But let's be fair about this. It's going to take a while, and by a while I mean 1 or 2, 3, 4, 5 years, before we see a marked difference. The fact that there is now no ammonium nitrate or very little ammonium nitrate going into that estuary is going to mean that fish are going to start to come back and use the estuary as the nursery. In the springtime, you can go along the estuary edge and you will see, I would say, not just thousands, but millions of little tiny flounder along the edge. And they've come in from the breeding banks outside the Waimak and the Waitaki, places like that. And they come in ostensibly to increase in size and grow. But with the ammonium nitrate in there, of course, they don't. Now, without all these small fish coming in, we're not going to get the other pelagic fishes, like the kawai, coming in to chase what's not there. If I think back, when we had a lot of fish in the estuary.
When was that? When would you place it?
Oh, that would be the 70s, early 80s. There would be huge flocks of white front terns all diving onto white bait and the yellow-eyed mullet, and they would be pushed to the surface by the kawai, and there would be terns everywhere. Terns everywhere, and of course the spotted shags from the cliffs out at Sumner. They would be in there, all fishing. It doesn't happen anymore. But I've got a gut, I know it's going to happen. I mean, you consider that the question of white bait. The white bait, the Ananga, comes down from the higher reaches of the rivers. They release their eggs into the margins on a high tide, a spring tide. The eggs will sit there, and then on the next big spring tide, they will be flushed out into the sea as embryonic fish on the high tide to be met by a plume of ammonium nitrate rich stuff coming out of the ponds. They're dead before they reach the sea. Whereas now that's not going to happen. And I think you'll find that the white bait will start to come back to where that ought to be.
Oh, I look forward to hearing more about those developments. On the beach itself, have you noticed any change in the presentation of shells? Because you've got a bit of a collection of shells.
Yeah. I have to say that this Brighton beach here is extremely prolific in the number and the number of species of different shell we find there. And I found that when they were putting the pipeline in, there were shells showing up there that I had not normally seen, such as shining sunset shells and things like that, which I put down to the fact they were digging them out when they were putting the trench in. And also, recently, I haven't seen any of those sunset shells. Can you say that? So I'm pretty sure that there must be beds out there that they found when they were putting the trench out.
This is really just coming to the final few questions, bringing it into a very personal domain. You live beside the estuary, and you've got the beach not very far away and the spit close at hand. Is there an aspect of the rhythm of the estuary and the beach, or an aspect of the seasons that you particularly enjoy?
Well, obviously I enjoy all part of it, whether summer, spring, autumn, winter. Okay, it's different. You've got different birds arriving. All different species of birds getting here. I don't think the species of birds are going to be made any different with the fact that we've cleaned the estuary up. The stuff that's affected by this cleaning up of the estuary is underwater, rather than the bird population. But it's just that I can walk out of my front door here, and within a few hundred yards I could be miles from anywhere. The only houses you can see when you get out there are the houses on the hill. I often think to myself, poor buggers, all they can do is sit up there and look at it. They can't get themselves involved and enjoy it like we can down here on the flat.
Do you recall any standout experience of seeing something or a particular gathering or some occasion where your heart's been filled by, you know, maybe that happens on a regular basis, by the opportunity for you to participate in this kind of lifestyle?
Yeah. Apart from the fact we've had the odd whale washed up, the thing that gets me is I could come home from work, look out the window and think, well, it's high tide, there's no wind, we can go and pick up a few flounder. Now, if I lived in Fendleton, God forbid, I couldn't do that, because it was then a question of getting into a car and coming out here to see if the estuary is in fact flat. Here, I can just walk a few hundred yards, look at the water, ideal, come back, pick up my spear and light, and I can get into it. And I think it's that. It's there. The whole estuary is immediately available to you.
Going back to the first interview session that I did with you, and you spoke about the lifestyle that you had in East England?
East Anglia.
East Anglia, thank you.
Yeah.
East Anglia, stumbling on that. The description that you've just given to me sounds a bit like the way that you talked about it being a way of life when you were living there. Do you think that your attitudes and your value of being able to enjoy these things has altered here in New Zealand, or are they essentially similar?
Well, certainly it's altered, because in England I did very little river fishing, whereas here in New Zealand I'm doing mainly river fishing. But the difference is, I suppose, that one of my main enthusiasm in England was wildfowling. Now, the wildfowling season in England, of course, is 6 months long and there's no bag limit. I'm assuming it's still the same. I don't know. But when I was there, there was no bag limit. It was 6 months season for ducks, for pheasants, partridge, whatever. Whereas here, of course, you're limited to about two ducks and a few weeks. So in England, it's more a way of life, because you've got time then to have a properly trained dog, whereas here, to have a properly trained dog for about a fortnight hardly seems worthwhile, unless you're going on different stuff. But it's different. It's neither better nor worse. It's just different.
And as far as putting back into the environment, what's your personal take on that? And do you feel that your personal value is one that you'd like to see others take up?
Yeah. Yes, I think in the more controlled environment of England, you take on more of an ownership. and in England we were raising ducks that were in decline, and I'm thinking particularly of pintail duck. And I was involved with a group of people from our local wildfowling association to increase the numbers of pintail duck. Now, some people might say, well, you're only doing it so you can shoot them. But pintail duck were not on the, were not allowed to be shot anyway. We were doing it to try and put back what we had taken out of the environment. It wasn't just pintail. I mean, we were raising mallard as well. And I would like to see the shooting fraternity here do more of that. Take ownership of the area that you're shooting in. Take ownership of the wildfowl. Take ownership of the everything that's going on around you. And don't do things that you know are going to degenerate the wildlife that we have here. I always think of this, the motto. I belong to an association called WAGBI. And it was the Wildfowl Association of Great Britain and Ireland. And the one of the main sponsors there was the Duke of Edinburgh. And he used to come along to the odd big meeting and put forward an extremely humorous and informed things. And the motto of the association was a comment made by King George V. And he made the comment that the wildlife of today is not ours to dispose of as we please. We have it in trust for those who come after us. And I think that's what we should try and maintain, that idea.
And I'm presuming you mean the flora, the fauna, and the land, land and the water.
Yeah. Yeah. Try and leave it better than when you found it.
Well, Peter, that concludes the questions that I had to ask you. Can you think of anything else that you'd like to add?
No, I can't. Really? My mind's gone a blank after all these questions. I can't think of anything else other than that last statement that we should look after what we've got.
All right, well, it's been a pleasure to meet with you, and I appreciate both you, your hospitality and the time that you've spent with me. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.